powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
So every single Friday before Seahawks game, we do two things. One is we open up phone lines at 1 p.m. Every single Friday, even when it's not a Seahawks game, we have open phone lines. We turn it over to you guys. And I'll tell you guys the question and then give you again the number to call coming up at 1. So that's one thing we do. The other thing we do is basically a trivia. It's a game show style quiz in which Curtis and Jake face off. Who's got the series lead right now?
It's tied.
Season? It's tied. Okay, series is tied so far this season.
Not for long.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, one of you will literally.
It is impossible for us
for long
to tie today.
One of you will literally win today. I had a lot of fun with this one. And I think this one will be because of the nature of the rarity of winning in home stadiums or on the road for each of these teams. I think this one is going to be like a listener favorite.
Wow.
I just think it's a good like memory.
Really?
Game. Yeah, it's a good kind of dig into the memory bank kind of trivia game. I'm really excited. I'm most proud of this one.
Really?
It's gonna
I'm excited
be a good
to see.
Don't you?
So
don't you also say that every week,
Jake? Not now. So that's coming up at 1:30. So calls at 1:00. The trivia quiz at 1:30. I'm really excited for our final hour. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a good one. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and...
Really pumped for the final hour.
Really pumped for the final. I mean, the rest of it's going
to
be a nightmare.
We still got a couple more hours to get to.
Oh, God. I hope you guys can hang out.
Boy, that noon hour? Boy.
No, well, hey, I've got a chance for you to win tickets to see the Seahawks host the Cardinals. I'll tell you what you need to do in a couple minutes here. First, though, how did the Seahawks get a win this Sunday against Green Bay? We're doing this as a kind of want to see versus need to see. Here's how it works, Jake. We're going to say something we want to see, something that would be nice. It would be icing on the cake, a cherry on top of the sundae kind of thing.
Okay.
And then something we need to see where, like, if you don't do this, the Seahawks aren't winning.
Okay.
So I might want to see a Jamal Adams interception, as was my bold take. I don't need to see it. I don't think they need to intercept Aaron Rodgers to win the game. I think they need to stop Aaron Rodgers and stop that offense. So so that kind of thing is what I want us to go. So why don't you start with what you want to see?
Okay, so what I want to see...
And then tell us why.
I want the Seahawks pass rush to be consistent and effective against Aaron Rodgers. I know Daryl Taylor will do his thing, and I know that he is going to generate pressure. I know that he may even get his sack himself. I mean, it's just kind of what he's done this year, and it's been awesome to watch him. But who's going to step up alongside him? And it's got to be Carlos Dunlap, Benson Mayoa, Kerry Hyder Jr. They have to deliver. I will be curious to see, along with that... if their approach at all changes in the way that Ken Norton Jr. and Pete Carroll try to send pressure against Aaron Rodgers when they utilize Jamal Adams, will they utilize Bobby Wagner, Jordan Brooks more? And if they send Jamal Adams, are they going to continue to keep using the same obvious fire zone blitzes where they're dropping Benson Mayo into coverage, or are they going to mix it up a little bit more where it's a little bit more difficult for the offensive lineman and the quarterback himself to pick up on exactly what they're trying to do? That to me is something that I'm going to be very curious about when it comes to the pressure side of it. But when it comes to pass rush and winning your one-on-one battles, Carlos Dunlap, Benson Mayo, and Kerry Hyder Jr. all combined have just 2 sacks. Two sacks on the season thus far. That is completely unacceptable, and that is not winning football. So if what I want to see, I want to see that pocket getting suffocated around Aaron Rodgers, making it difficult for him, having to speed his clock up a little bit and not allow him to just sit back there and just be comfortable picking apart the Seahawks defense, Stacey, and that's going to have to come through a pass rush, a consistent pass rush.
What's the difference in what you see from Aaron Rodgers under pressure or not? Any quarterback, no matter how good he is better without pressure. Like, it's just a given, like a fact of football. But some guys have bigger gaps under pressure versus no pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that when you're talking about Aaron Rodgers, the gap is vast. I mean, when you're looking at Aaron Rodgers, you're looking at what he's able to do from a clean pocket or even a pocket that is muddy that he could step into and create outside. He's one of the best quarterbacks to ever play the game. I mean, he can pick you apart all game long. But if you truly can get to him, can hit him, can harass him, like the San Francisco 49ers have been able to do in the past. That, to me, is something that when you are able to do that and get him off his spot, he becomes very frustrated very quickly and is not in sync with his throws. And that, to me, is not completely different from universally every single quarterback, but that is the one way that you can make Aaron Rodgers not play like Aaron Rodgers.
All right. I love those. I'm going to go offense and defense, but kind of focus on a different area. So,
okay.
Love the idea of the pass rush. I think that's a huge, huge key to stopping any quarterback, to stopping Aaron Rodgers. And if you're looking at, you know, like, hey, their defense is solid. Russell Wilson's coming back. He's not going to be at 100%. Dee Eskridge is coming back, but he hasn't played since week one. Like, you got to get some help. You got to get some complimentary football there and not have it lean on just one side of the ball. What I want to see, I'm going to stick with my my play on the ball. I'm going to stick with either a big sack in a big moment or an interception. Like, I want to see a Seahawks takeaway. I think that the more possessions you can give your offense, the better, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's just there's a reason, and it sounds basic, that turnover differential typically leads to a win. Not always. Sometimes a team with a worse turnover differential gets the win, but typically, if you stay on the field, if you get more possessions, you get more shots at the end zone. So that's what I want to see. And not only that, but there's mounting pressure on guys like Jamal Adams to get an interception or for the Seahawks to get a takeaway. They've been good about not giving it away. Quite honestly, that's probably going to change once they start airing it out a bit more, just the nature of passing. But I would like to see a play on the ball, either a pass batted down, a big sack by Daryl Taylor or Carlos Dunlap would be mm-hmm. fantastic, or an interception. What I need to see is the Seahawks maintain their success on third down defensively and improve their success on third down offensively. So right now, the Seahawks on third down, in terms of limiting third down conversions from opposing offenses, are hovering around 30%. They're 29% right now since week four. That's third best in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And they're already, I think, number five or so in the league overall. So they've been great overall this season, especially of late, at getting off the field on third down. And I know someone texted in earlier and was like, what about fourth down? Overwhelmingly, getting off the field on third down in most cases, unless the team is trailing or has short yardage, means you're getting off the field for fourth down as well.
Right.
So I'll give them credit there. They've done that against poorer offenses than Green Bay. So I want to see, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Are you allowing them to convert on 50% or are you still limiting it to around 30? Anything under 38 would be huge.
It would be big for this team. And the reason why I think you're absolutely right in pointing to that area of the field, the third down situations, both offensively and defensively, is because there's a strong correlation between winning, strong correlation between points scored based off of the success or lack thereof on third down. So that is an area that, without fail, that the Seattle Seahawks offense has really struggled with over the past couple seasons, and that has to change. They've got to be more precise. They've got to execute better in those third down situations. The other aspect of that as well, as you mentioned the defense, I want to see the defense prove this. I want nothing more than to see the Seattle Seahawks defense play great against this Green Bay's offense, and Aaron Rodgers. I would love nothing more than that, because that would tell me that this defensive turnaround is legitimate, that this defensive turnaround is something that you can actually count on moving forward into each and every single game that you play. And that is a big, big part of this, you know, in terms of the strategy of the way Pete Carroll likes to manage games. So to me, that would be very, very positive if this defense really was on a, you know, quote unquote turnaround here. And if they can do that versus the Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers, my confidence soars in their ability to do that against the Arizona Cardinals and Kyler Murray. So that is something that I want to see happen. But I got to be honest with you, Stacey, I'm really, really nervous about it. And I'm not as confident as other people when they look at the stats and say, see what the Seahawks defense has done as of late. I'm sorry. I saw in the second half of the year where you played in 2020, where you played some, you know, poor offenses and were able to feast upon that. You've done that so far the last three games against the Steelers, the Saints, and the Jacksonville Jaguars. The Packers offense, Aaron Rodgers, if he's playing, that's a totally different beast, a totally different animal, and that would carry more weight in my eyes than anything else.
Agree 1,000%. I want to tack on one final stat. I know we've got to get to four down territory here in just 1 minute, and I want to give you guys the info you need for those tickets. So.
Well, I got to get to my need, too.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, Jake, go for it.
Jeez. I want you to say
what... Okay, all I'll say is someone texted in, and a fair argument said, well, that's because Seattle's defense is allowing opponents to convert on first and second downs. It's actually not. The increase in their production, the defense's production on third down, is genuinely getting off the field on third down and not allowing conversions. Seattle's allowed 24 first downs per game this season on average, and that's heavily skewed towards the first couple weeks. They're like number two there. Over the last three games, that has dipped by about 3 to 4 first downs per game. So they genuinely are limiting conversions on defense. And Green Bay was number one in the league last year on third down efficiency at 50%. This year, they've dropped all the way to 39%, which is about what Seattle did last year. Okay, Jake.
What I need to see from the Seattle Seahawks in this game is I need to see the offense find success as it flows through Russell Wilson. And what do I mean by that? Flow through Russell Wilson. What I mean is you got to be aggressive on first and second down. You've got to be aggressive on first and second down in your passing game, not being afraid to be able to distribute the football to DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, and the other weapons that you have on this offensive roster. To me, that is the biggest key for them to find success and to embrace that aspect of it, knowing that it doesn't mean that you're getting away from the running game and that you can't have a solid established run presence to your offense. Got to find easy completions early, got to put him in positions to attack with tempo, and you've got to allow him to have that freedom at the line of scrimmage to be able to keep you one step ahead. It shouldn't even be a question as to what they should do or how they should go about it, but yet here we are at this point of the season and however many years Russell's been in the league for the Seattle Seahawks. But to me, if you're going to see this team really take off in the second half of the season, Russell Wilson's going to be a huge reason why you're doing it, along with the defensive, you know, the defense having a legitimate turnaround. You've got to see this offense, you know, live up to the expectations of what we all thought this group was capable of doing and becoming at the start of this season.
All right. And now it's time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru, Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
First down, Jake, for the Seahawks to win, what has to hold true for the defense since week four?
Well, what has to hold true is they've got to be excellent on third downs, as you talked about. What the other thing that they have been excellent in that is a really key statistical category is their red zone defense. Their red zone defense has been fantastic since that week four period, and that is something that you've got to contain the Green Bay Packers when they get in the red zone. If they can contain the Green Bay Packers when they enter the red zone, it gives you the very, very best chance to win. So instead of touchdowns for Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers, they're kicking field goals. And if you can effectively make them and force them into kicking field goals for the majority of the game, the Seahawks offense is good enough to be able to put up points and walk out of Lambeau Field with a win. So that, to me, is going to be the key for this Seahawks defense.
Second down. Were the Rams ultimately the best fit for OBJ?
I believe so. I absolutely believe that when you look at it, that he is... Well, let me walk that back a second. Out of the financial and the offense that they run, the financial situation, the offense they run, it was the best scenario for OBJ. The very best scenario, I thought, for Odell Beckham Jr., would quite frankly, was the Green Bay Packers. You know, they don't have anybody established. They don't have anybody established outside of Devontae Adams. Yeah, you're not fighting for targets nearly as much, you know, away from Devontae Adams. Devontae Adams would be thrilled to have Odell Beckham Jr. there. You know, with all the attention that Devontae Adams gets and the creativity that they have to go into just to get Devontae Adams the football as much as they do, they don't have a ton of dynamic receiving weapons. They've got good players, someone that I'll talk about here in just a second here. But they don't have just a ton of guys across the board that are game-breaking, game-changing type of weapons that you've got to tilt the coverage towards outside of Devontae Adams. And that would have been a great fit for Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. But Green Bay didn't want to pay him. They didn't want to pay him any money, so they wanted to pay him just the veteran minimum, whereas the Rams, they were more than willing to do that. But even with Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods there and Tyler Higbee and that whole crew, I think Odell Beckham Jr., what he's going to be is he's going to be a menace in man-to-man situations. He's going to be a menace in those one-on-one matchups. And when he gets the opportunity to have those matchups, I guarantee you Matthew Stafford is going to find him often in those scenarios, and that's where OBJ has to show to the rest of the league that, hey, I am still a guy that can destroy and eat up man-to-man coverage. That's why you're willing to pay me the big dollars.
I wonder, obviously, Seahawks fans are going to hope it's Seattle in this case, just as any NFC team is going to hope it's their team. But I wonder what it'll be like if OBJ is still with the Rams and is still healthy with the Rams, and then they face off against the Packers in the NFC Championship. Like, I wonder if we will have totally forgotten about this narrative and totally forgotten about this moment where he chose the Rams over the Packers.
Yeah.
And we'll be on to some other thing.
Possibly. I mean, the NFL is, I mean, man, it's a drama cooker. I mean, you just know that there's some big story that's going to happen at any given point.
It's like suddenly Jordan
within
Love's
the NFL. Yeah. Right. But no, I do think that this is a defining moment that everybody's going to be looking at and seeing what the Rams do now that they have acquired Von Miller, now that they have acquired OBJ, and really the excuses for them to perform, not perform. They have nowhere to hide. Sean McVay has nowhere to hide. This Rams team has to produce, and quite frankly, they're fine with that because I believe that they're the three. If I'm going to bank on anybody being in the NFC Championship game, it's three teams. It's Tampa Bay, it's the Rams, and it's the Green Bay Packers at this point. Those three teams are vying for that opportunity to be in the NFC Championship game. And so if you're the Rams, you'll take those chances and run with it every single time.
As someone who also speaks very loudly, one of my favorite things about Sean McVay is that he yell talks. Have you guys heard him in a press conference? This guy, like...
Oh, absolutely.
He is either not talking or screaming. There's no in-between. His press conferences, just answering questions, he's like, yeah, you know what we do is... He's just yelling at all times. I love it. Third down. Who's the underrated weapon for Aaron Rodgers that concerns you?
The guy that concerns me is Alan Lazard. So everybody's, you know, talks about Devontae Adams and fully agree. I mean, there's no question. I'm saying somebody outside of Devontae Adams and Aaron Jones that everybody's going to point to as their dynamic playmakers, but a guy that no one really pays attention to that can absolutely make you pay is Alan Lazard. He is a big receiver, a strong receiver, very savvy. You know, he reminds me, doesn't make any of the big plays that this player has made in his past, but he reminds me a lot of Jermaine Kearse, just in the reliability
factor.
Like, he'll
suddenly pop up in the biggest moment.
Yeah, I mean, he just has a knack for being able to come up with that third down catch, has a knack for being able to come up with a big play here in critical situations, and is somebody that Aaron Rodgers trusts. So Alan Lazard to me is another guy that if you're this Seahawks defense and you know you're so worried about Devontae Adams, don't forget that they've got a good receiver that can make you pay, especially in the red zone with Alan Lazard.
Fourth down. Let's talk run game. Chris Carson is going to be a game day decision. You'll hear from Pete Carroll later today, and then we'll tell you what he had to say on the Pete Carroll preview. But basically, Chris Carson, 50-50 chance to play is what it feels like right now. So how important is the run game for the Seahawks against the Packers?
Absolutely vital. Absolutely vital. And if you just look at it from a statistic point of view, going into this game, it's where the Green Bay Packers struggle the most. I mean, you just look at it statistically. I mean, they are top five in total defense, they're top five in passing defense, but they are 16th in run defense. So this is an area of the field that they are weaker in, but don't get me wrong, they are a very good run defense. Sometimes those stats can be misleading, but I do see an opportunity for the Seahawks in the running game to be able to get things going, and to me it's a matter of pinpointing the amount of times correctly that they need to run the football, pinpointing the different ways that they need to run the football, and being diverse enough in their running game where they don't become predictable. Because if you're predictable, this run Packers defense is really, really good. Really good. They get downhill fast. They're physical. They'll meet you at the point of attack. And so if you can make it a little bit more diverse, you don't get those guys flying downhill nearly as fast, and that's where teams have had success running the football against the Green Bay Packers.
Okay, do you guys want to win tickets to see the Seahawks host the Cardinals at Lumen Field? I know you do. That game's coming up November 21st, and here's how you can do it. Text the word Hawks, H-A-W-K-S. I've seen some of you guys texting Hawk singular. It's Hawks with an S. Don't forget that. Text the word Hawks, H-A-W-K-S, to our new text line, 206-421-3776 to learn how. The contest ends this Monday at midnight, so text Hawks right now to 206-421-3776 for your chance to enter to win. Don't forget, you can watch the show live on 710sports.com/video, and Football Fridays are powered by the Snoqualmie Casino Sportsbook. Coming up in the timeline, have you ever seen an unintentional self-own? That basically happened with the promotion that this team is trying to run. That's next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacy.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It is The Timeline on Jake and Stacy, reading you the top stories you're going to see on your own timelines. Let's start with this one. Now, I mentioned a self-own, and that might be being a little bit harsh. It's being a little bit harsh, but, you know, it kind of feels like that with this one. So the LA Clippers are giving away $10,000 to one fan at each home game for the rest of November. That's
wow.
Pretty sweet. It's a pretty sweet promotion, right? You go to a game, you have a chance to win $10,000.
That's Steve Ballmer money.
That's Steve Ballmer money at every single home game, $10,000. It's pretty sweet. Here's the catch. Fans have to be in the arena 15 minutes prior to tip-off, and
okay.
Now this is the most important part. You have to be actually wearing Clippers colors.
Ooh, that's the
to
tough
be
part.
Eligible to win
in LA.
Ooh, now
not,
what the
not a lot of people
what
wearing
the Clippers
colors
have
in
been
that
struggling
town.
With is getting their fans to show up on time. And not having other fans of the other team wearing those colors. Mm. And the team describes it as an attempt to, quote, make fashionably late unfashionable. Can you imagine?
Good luck.
It's kind of
good
like
luck. You're telling me the scene of L.A. cares about your unfashionable
they barely
late
care
standards.
About the Rams like they like to show up to a Clippers game. I just like the idea of being like, we will pay you $10,000 if you show up on time.
Please show up on time. And you know what, if you do, based off of what it sounds like you got a pretty good chance to win 10 grand. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. The other thing is they're begging people to wear their colors. So does that mean that it needs to be team-issued gear or just simply their colors?
Just red and blue?
Clippers colors. Oh, that's a good question. I am going to assume
that would be even funnier.
No,
just
I'm
please
assume...
just wear anything in your closet that is red or blue. Just something. Just something.
I'm going to assume that it's like Clippers gear. But I just I like the idea that the basic thing is like, hey, show up, wear red and blue. Like, wear team colors and just be there on time. You know what I mean? Just show up to the game and be there on time. It's a simple ask. And we will literally give you $10,000 to do that. And still there might be some fans that are like,
I don't know. Just rush hour traffic.
I don't know.
Yeah. And you probably got a majority of them being like, $10,000? What is that going to do for me?
What? No way. $10,000 is a lot.
I don't need that. I shop at...
Yeah, if you're a celebrity, you don't care.
I shop at Gucci. I shop at, Stacy. All
Rodeo
these people that are...
I'm
on
not
Rodeo.
The average fan. I know we're in L.A. right now,
Lakers
but come
fans
on.
Probably
Lakers
shop
fans
on Rodeo
maybe.
Drive.
Clippers fans.
Clippers fans are shopping at Ross and TJ Maxx.
How dare you? How dare you? Lots of Maxinistas right now really offended by that, Curtis. Let me get to some injury news here before we do this. We do have some updates. The IRG injury report brought to you by IRG Physical and Hand Therapy. Pete Carroll confirmed on 973 Cairo FM that D. Eskridge will be available available Sunday, and Chris Carson is still a game time decision.
Yes, Chris, looks like he's going to make it, and Chris will have to wait all the way till game time if we don't know before then.
This is part of the Pete Carroll preview, which airs every single Friday on Kyber Radio. One other thing I'm going to tack on here. We know that Russell Wilson had like an insane comeback. He was given like maybe an eight, potentially longer than 8 week timeline. Instead, he's back and forth. Here's what Pete Carroll said about that.
You know, maybe a lot of people have people that they know in their lifetime that just they're just different than other people, you know, and they don't go by the scheduled kind of calendar that they have their own calendar in mind, and time is not the same to them. With Russ, you know, he expected to be back playing. He thinks he was ready to play at the end of 4 weeks. He could have played on Sunday and last Sunday, and that's what he was shooting for, so that he would know that he would have another week to get ready for the next week. So I mean, that's so far ahead of schedule.
That was Pete Carroll saying that Russell Wilson's plan was to be back last Sunday against the Jags.
I always love those kind of conversations because it's like, really? Is that something that we can say right now? It's just in jest, like, oh, he could have been ready to play this last week, but I don't know. I don't know about that.
No, I think he was saying he was trying to make it to where he could play because then he'd have the bye week to prepare rather than like in the mindset of coming back is what I interpreted.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes more sense to me because that is, you know, when you talk about his preparation through the week, I mean, it was not just, you know, hey, I'm going to throw the ball a few times. It was a serious heavy workload. Once he started throwing and really going after it and trying to build up that workload for his arm so that he could feel like he's in the best position to, you know, go out there and rip it on Sunday and feel normal. So that to me makes more sense. It's great to be able to, you know, say that you've got a good feeling that Dee Eskridge is going to come back, and the fact that Chris Carson's a game time decision doesn't really bother me as much because him just getting to that point of being a game time decision is positive news in my opinion. I believe they're just being super, super cautious when it comes to Chris Carson because that injury could flare up at any time, and that's quite honestly, it's a terrible position to be in for the player and for the team to just kind of have that feeling of uneasiness and unknown as to what's going to happen with the player.
Now, you also have Pete Carroll talking about whether or not Russ is going to be at 100%, which is maybe the bigger question people have. The two questions being, hey, is he going to play with anything on his throwing finger? Pete Carroll's been asked that at press conferences all week long, and so far has said, look, Russ is trying out some different stuff, but he's capable of playing without anything on there. So we don't know what he's going to do yet. We're still trying it out. It might be nothing, like nothing on his hand. Pete also said, look, Russ may not be at 100%. But
so we don't have anything to really be concerned about. I mean, I don't know how you. Maybe he's 100%. I don't know, but I'm not worried about it. You know, I mean, maybe he's not too because he's just worked his way and willed his way through this, and so we're gonna play football and be excited to go.
But he's not worried about it.
Not worried about it.
Not worried about it.
Not worried about it because it looks like he's throwing it pretty darn well. So as long as there's not a ton of discomfort, as long as you know there's not a huge change in the way that Russell Wilson's throwing the football. You know, that finger could still not be 100% and everything's going to be just fine. So, Stacey, how about this that just popped up on my timeline? Robinson Cano, you remember that guy?
No.
Served 162 game suspension. It is finally been served to its fullest,
okay.
Which means he is reinstated from the restricted list officially on Wednesday. He is, so this next Wednesday, he will be back on the active roster, which also means on the payroll. So the Mets owe him $40.5 million the next 2 years, and the Mariners are paying him $7.5. Holy cow. I mean, out of anything that Jerry DePoto has done here in Seattle, that is probably the best thing that he has ever pulled off, which is getting rid of that Cano contract.
Question. I'm raising my hand for it. And Curtis, for you as well, for the two of you.
You're raising my hand?
Does the best trade, this trade, that Jerry DePoto has ever made outweigh the worst trade he has ever made?
So that'd be Chris Taylor for Zach Lee?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. This outweighs that.
I think so, too.
I mean, by and away, right? I mean, just I don't understand. Man, that's a bad contract. That's a bad contract to get into. And just thinking that Robinson Cano just completely forgot about him and seeing him just pop up on my timeline like that knowing that he's still got a couple years left and he's getting paid that money to essentially, I don't even know how, Curtis, do you know how he fits on that roster?
Boy, I mean.
No?
Yeah.
Maybe he.
The pocketbook?
Yeah.
Does he even have a role on this team anymore?
Yeah, the
maybe
role is
it's second base,
the
but they have Jeff McNeil. I mean, like,
right.
You look at that team. One great storyline about the Robinson Cano trade that I don't think gets mentioned enough is that Brody Van Wagenen, who was the GM at the time, used to be Robinson Cano's agent, and that's why he traded for Cano.
I laugh every time we talk about him, and I don't know why it's so unfair, but I just do.
Poor Brody out of a job
Brody.
Right now.
Dude, right. It is hilarious. I mean, why would you do that to yourself?
This hour of... Let's end it with that question because there's no real answer. This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. We've got some rumblings from MLB's GM meetings coming your way next, including a big report from Jeff Passan on Corey Seager and Marcus Semien. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
Some rumblings from the GM meetings of MLB that are occurring right now. We'll start with this one from Jeff Passan. So there are a couple
names.
I love
rumblings.
I love rumblings too. There are a couple names we've all talked about in terms of our own personal wish lists for Mariners signings and free agency. Marcus Semien is maybe the top one, though lots of people want Corey Seager, maybe Carlos Correa if you want to potentially move JP around. I know that Chris Bryant has been on some people's list. We've got him in some reports here, too. Justin Verlander's been out there. He's not included here, but he's been another name. So I'll start with this one. ESPN's Jeff Passan reports the markets for Corey Seager and Marcus Semien have accelerated to the point where they could sign with the team before the expected December 1st lockout. As a reminder, CBA negotiation is going to be happening here. I think a lockout is anticipated for at least some amount of time. And so a lot of people are thinking there could be just a pause with free agency where maybe teams aren't making any significant moves for a couple months here. Maybe they wait that out. But it looks like there could be a chance that some of the top guys, we're talking the top shortstops with Correa not mentioned here, but among the top guys are those shortstops, Correa, Corey Seager, and then here, Marcus Semien included, that they could be off the market before that lockout happens.
Yeah, I would love to be able to have this done early, to be quite honest with you. If the Mariners were able to pull off this signing of Marcus Semien, wouldn't that just be a huge win for the Mariners and Jerry Dipoto in terms of what they're trying to establish, in terms of every other conversation that they walk into in trying to recruit other free agents? I mean, I just think it would be such a coup for them to be able to pull this off and to be able to land Marcus Semien. And the one thing that I want to hear is I want to hear how aggressive the Mariners are going to be to make that happen. Like, that's the next step. Okay, if that's where the market is leaning towards and things are heating up and it looks like there could be a deal that gets done for both of those teams, because there's teams out there, I mean, I'm reading into it that the teams are out there willing to spend the money and lock this thing up and say, all right, whatever dollar amount you're asking there, what is it, Scott Boras?
Yeah, the super agent.
Yeah, the super agent who just is just constantly representing guys and getting them overpaid or big contracts. All right, Scott Boras, whatever you're putting out there, we'll match it. Or at least we'll get pretty darn close to it, to the point where you don't feel like you need to drag this thing on. That I am perfectly fine with. I mean, does this make you uneasy to know that there are that many other teams that are right there in the hunt or in that conversation?
No, because I would have anticipated that. These are the top guys that are going to be out there. I'm anticipating that many teams are pushing for Semien, pushing for Correa, pushing for Seager, and I'm already ruling the Mariners out for Seager, but I mean, the Mariners, if they want to be big spenders, they're competing with a lot of other guys this time around.
Right. Yeah, they are. They are competing big time, and that is where we're going to see very quickly the resolve of this organization with the Mariners and with Jerry Dipoto and everything that they've talked and they've preached about how aggressive they're going to be and they're willing to expand payroll. Okay, to what degree? How aggressive are you really going to get in order to improve and upgrade this roster? And that is what we're all waiting on. We're all right, you've got me to this point. I am believing, based off of what you said and based off of the rebuilding aspect of the way you've gone about this, that you are going to follow through on what you have said. But at the same time, Stacey, you can't forget the past.
Yeah.
And what this organization has also done and has burned, you know, the fans in the past to the point where, okay, we still need to see the actions follow up the words and what you're saying here.
We heard earlier this week from Kylie McDaniel of ESPN, one of their baseball insiders, kind of say that the second wave of free agency, guys like Marcus Stroman, Carlos Rodon, those could be areas where the Mariners pounce in free agency and kind of round out the roster. But how important is it going to be for the Mariners to strike early in free agency to maybe send a message out there that says, hey, we mean what we're doing, or we mean what we say when we're going to spend here. Look at what we just added, whether it be through free agency or maybe a trade.
I think the most important thing clearly is to be able to get their guy. If their guy is Marcus Semien, let's say hypothetically, they're like, we want this to be our top target. We don't want to move JP. Someone texted in on the Mac and Jack's text line. What about JP? Jerry DePoto loves JP. He's made it clear he wants to keep him at shortstop. So that's why everyone's kind of looking at Marcus Semien as being the top of that group to be targeted by Seattle instead, because he has a bit more versatility there to go to second. If that's your guy, then it's less about timing and more of like, get it done. Mm-hmm. Don't be hesitant about when you're going to get it done. Like, you're going to have to be aggressive in free agency in a way you haven't been in many years. So I don't know that I'm reading into them not getting, if the names being thrown around were Corey Seager and Carlos Correa, and the Mariners maybe like weren't, not that they weren't in on it, but didn't get anything done, I'd be like, okay. But I feel like Marcus Semien is a name they've got to be more open to.
100%.
So
100%.
Curtis, that was a roundabout way, and it sounds like a cop-out answer to your question, but that is to say, like, I care less about them getting something done early for the sake of proving they're aggressive and more about them getting done when it's clear there's a fit for them.
This is the very best fit for them. In terms of what they want to do and how they want to go about this, Marcus Semien, to me, is the best fit out of anybody in this market. And then from there, you can start to piecemeal how you round out your roster, how you, you know, figure out the outfield, how you figure out third base, what you need to do from that point forward. But if you make the middle of your infield with J.P. Crawford and Marcus Semien over the next few years, that is an exciting proposition. Then you get aggressive at third base, either via trade or getting yourself back into the market with another name that we had news of where, you know, the MLB Network interviewed The Athletic's Andrew Baggerly. And, you know, he's talking about how the Giants aren't likely to bring Chris Bryant back.
Yeah, I was going to jump. Do you want me to introduce that one?
Let's jump
to that one.
Yeah, let's go to that.
So Andrew Baggerly on MLB Network says Chris Bryant is unlikely to come back to San Francisco. He says the Giants weren't very impressed. This from Greg Zumak, weren't very impressed with Chris Bryant, especially defensively at third, center, and right field. He also notes the swing won't age well.
See, this one is weird to me. When you hear that, I mean, we've heard the criticism of him and this same point about his swing with Chicago, and now you're hearing it with the Giants. I mean, the guy's still producing. Curtis, is there something that I'm inherently missing on this situation? I'm not quite understanding why people are looking at Chris Bryant like the boogeyman here.
Yeah, it is. It is very confusing, and maybe it goes back to just the incredible start he got off to in his career, where he was putting up record numbers and won MVP his second year in the league, and hasn't exactly reached that level ever since. But that's not to say that he's a bad player. He's still a really good player and has tremendous value, and is only going to turn 30 years old in January.
He's 29. The way they're talking about him is like he's 34.
So is that what it is? Is that, okay, everybody thought that this guy was going to be a super duper star in Major League Baseball. That's what he was touted to be. That's what he was to start out with. And now he's fallen to being, what would you put him? A fringe all-star player, an all-star player?
And he made the all-star team last year.
Okay, so he's an all-star. So maybe he's not the very best player in baseball. Maybe you don't say he's a top five player in baseball. And I guess the caution here would be don't pay him like he's a top five player in baseball when he's not, right? But don't you get the sense that that's kind of how the market's going to dictate this thing anyways? That's how I view this, and that's why my optimism about Chris Bryant continues to go higher and higher, that I don't necessarily believe you're going to have to pay him like one of the very best free agents in baseball, you're going to have to pay him, but maybe not as big a money that you would have to fork out for some of these shortstops.
Yeah, I don't know. It's something. I this is a conversation that is fascinating to me, and we have to switch to bringing Michael Bumpus on here in just a minute, but it's one we're obviously going to keep tracking here. Don't forget, you can listen to us on the go or catch up with the show if you miss it. Subscribe to the Jake and Stacey podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. Don't forget to rate and review if you do subscribe. Michael Bumpus joins us next.